Welcome to episode 2 of the VR Side Chats podcast. This week I'm talking to Matt Litzler, who is a VR filmmaker and head of moving image for the innovation agency Brandwidth. So, without further ado, let's jump in. Well, Matt, thank you for joining me.
No worries.
Really appreciate it. So, could you sort of tell us a bit about your background and how you got into VR? Because obviously, you know, you've gone from, you know, acting to then sort of going behind the camera. So
yeah, so I was in a show on Channel 4 in the UK called Hollyoaks. I was in Hollyoaks for about 10 years. And while I was there, the Hollyoaks is made by a company called Lime Pictures, who are brilliant. But Lime Pictures is also, they're an educator. So they make a lot of short films at the weekends and in downtime. And what people that work at Lime Pictures can do is sort of, I don't know, you write a script and you pitch the sort of the producers and you say, I want to make a short film. And you get to do that. You can go and make your short films. But the rules are that everyone steps up. So if you want to, you know, if you're a camera assistant and you want to be a camera operator, it's on the short films where you can go and try that stuff. Or if you're a cameraman and you want to be a DOP, that's where you can go and, you know, you can go and make something tangible that you can put your name on, that you lit it, you were a DOP. Yeah. Or, you know, you could be a scriptwriter, or, you know, there's an opportunity for people to step up, try something new, and see if it fits. And I loved directing, always. I loved it. I loved writing and I loved directing. And so as a young man, I was probably 19, 20, 21, I think, started to make some short films at Lime Pictures. So I wrote them and I directed them, and people that I was working with on a day-to-day basis worked on it with me. So young lads about my age who were camera assistants were camera operators. It doesn't happen very often. It happens more often now, but back then it didn't. And there's a real sort of lovely feel to a lot of the short films that come out of Lime, because they tend to be people's sort of intuitive approach and quite largely altered by sort of one brain. Anyway, long story short, made a few films, took a couple to film festivals, won a couple of little awards, nothing major. Nice. But it gave me enough of a taste to kind of go, this is the way I want to do it, this is the direction I want to go in. So when my time came to sort of think about, you know, that point I was 23, 24. I've been in the show since I was 14. It's been there 10 years. Yeah. And I just had this sort of epiphany one day. I thought, hang on a minute, I'm 23, 24. This is a young person's show. And you know what? I could probably stay for a long time and have a happy, healthy, comfortable life here. But then in 10 years' time, I'm going to be terrified of being an old person in a young person's show. And I'm going to be, every time it comes, you know, September contract time, I'm going to be on the edge of my seat wondering if I'm going to get kept on or not. Right now, I'm 23, 24. I'm young enough to go and jump, retrain, and start something new. So I did that. I handed in my notice and said, guys, it's time to go. And the producer, Brian Kirkwood, said to me, look, can you do 6 months extra for me? And I was like, yeah, I can. If you do 6 months extra, we'll let you come back and direct a block of Hollyoaks. Actually, that suits me down to the ground. So I did my 6 months. Anyway, that never worked out for whatever reason. There's some legal stuff and some other stuff within, you know, wheels within wheels. I never got to do that block. But what it meant then was that last 6 months, I really got my head down and really studied and decided what I was going to do when I left. And I made one final short film. We took that to the New York Film Festival, and we won like Best International Short and stuff. And that was great. And we all went out to New York, and my girlfriend, who's now my wife and the mother of my children, she came out there, and this sort of real sort of odyssey of creativity. And it was fantastic. And I knew then that was the direction. So upon leaving, I went and did some training, and I did all the little jobs, the little sort of running and doing stuff for myself. And I made pilots for Channel 4, and I did some stuff for Channel 5, and I made documentaries for Channel 4 online. I made lots of content for, you know, joining other crews and going off to Germany and working for Microsoft for a few weeks in conference halls, and just getting on the sort of conveyor belt of shoot. And then I learned to edit as well. So then I became more useful to people like other production companies because they could just bring me in and I could go, I could shoot, I could edit, and then I could deliver the content as well. And then I got into event stuff for a while, and I was making content where we would get into the event, because quite often big conferences like like the clothes show and things like that, they're not ready until 10 minutes before the door.
Yeah.
But they like to have this social content that kind of goes, look at the show, come down this weekend. So we specialised for a while in getting in there 20 minutes before the show would open, running around with a gimbal, getting all the slow-mo shots, and then cutting it and having it kind of ready within 45 minutes to go when the show opens. And so we did that for a long time, and I made music videos and all sorts. And I sort of reached the point where it was time for me to throw me out in the ring and do it properly. And at that point, I had my first kid, a little girl called
always
Willow.
Away.
Yep, always away. And absolutely fell in love with her, and then kind of didn't want to go and be the dad that's away for 6 months of the year in the Croatia doing an episode of Last Kingdom or, you know, stuff like that. So I started to try and be a bit more freelance and a bit more independent. And I did that for a long time, and I made some lovely stuff, and I got to travel the world and see lots of little things. But I needed more stability. And I got chatting to a chap called Dean Johnson, who worked at a company called Bramwitz. And he's their head of innovation. And we got chatting over various channels for various reasons. And eventually Dean sort of said, look, why don't you come in and see what we like? So I came into the company. And within a couple of weeks, it became quite clear that they had enough output that they could probably take somebody on full time to run video production. So for a while, I sort of remained freelance, but kind of permalance with them. Yeah. And then like 2016, they said, look, just come on. And just run the department. So came to Bramwitz to make films, but Bramwitz is an innovation agency.
Yeah.
And a lot of, as I talk about a lot of what we do is sort of bleeding edge tech, stuff that, you know, we get all the stuff in the prototype phase and figure out how to break it and how to use it better and how to do things that it's not supposed to do. And we've got some amazing minds that work with us here. Mm. I've got a guy called Alex, he's kind of savant when it comes to anything to do with programming and tech. And, you know, I can give him a task and he'll solve it usually within about 12 hours. Like he learned RGB color space in about 6 hours and wrote me a line of code for FFmpeg for an image compositing, in binary that just was so good that we gave it to the client and they were like, can we buy, yeah, that's great, the video project's great, can we buy that line of code as well? We were like, no, you can't buy the line of code. So there's some fantastic minds. And anyway, I'm sort of digressing slightly.
It's all right.
The VR thing came of being an innovation agency. So we were invited by Nokia, by a chap called Stuart English, to come and see a prototype camera. And that was the Ozo. That was the Nokia Ozo. Yeah. And Stuart was carrying it around in a bag, kind of like a bowling ball. and he brings this camera out, and it was like nothing I'd ever seen. And as a filmmaker, you know, I'm used to one lens and just worrying about one lens, one lens does, and trying to control that and how I tell a story in a kind of letterbox format, you know, 16:9 or a 3:2. And all of a sudden there were 8 lenses, and I went home that weekend and I started to try and write down how I would do that, how I would tell a story by removing all the rules that I'd got used to living within, if you get me. So I lost decided that I wanted to do it and to pursue this Nokia Ozo camera. So we did. We kind of, for a while, chased it all over the world. We went to the LA launch, we went to the London launch, and we were first in the queue. And true to Stuart and true to Nokia, they we had it. The prototype of it, we were the first independent company to get it outside of its embargo.
Nice.
So we took that Ozo camera that we were given for a week and we dragged it everywhere. We had it on top of cars, we had it in race cars, we had it on cruise ships, I had it in hospital operating theatres, building sites, I had it in gastropub kitchens, we had it at historic sites, just everywhere in a week. And we shot and shot and shot and shot and shot and shot and shot, because Browith isn't a startup, so I knew I had sort of 1 week's worth of time to go and make as many mistakes as possible.
Yeah.
Get into the edit and learn from those mistakes. And that was
so these weren't actual like client jobs or something that you was working on. You were just testing.
Just had this test, this 1 week of time, this test where I was just going to go and like I say, I needed to go, and it sounds like a backwards way of working, but I needed to go and get it wrong. Because
that's the best way.
Yeah,
always like, the best way.
And I'd already seen some other stuff, but after that week and after I'd spent. I mean, back then, to stitch a minute of footage took 24 hours with the kit we had. I can now stitch a minute of footage in about an hour. So, you know, we're talking 7 or 8 iterations of software, 9 or 10 firmware updates. Like, this was back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, standard film, that stuff doesn't happen anymore. This was like being there in Hollywood in the 30s, you know, as everything was being cemented. But it felt cool and it felt exciting. And every client we went in and showed them to, they were all sort of like blown away because no one had really seen proper video VR.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, this was like video VR version 1. And the first thing everyone always said was, why does it look like crap? And it did, you know. Although we were rendering out 4K video, you know, 4K by 4K, 4096 by 4096, 1:1 aspect ratio video for the epirectangular. It didn't look great. It was pixely and blocky and screen door and all those things that we've come to recognise within VR as being as bad. But over time, you know, Ozo has refined itself, and I keep finding myself coming back to it. I did a shoot last week for a Premiership football club, and I did the final update on the camera for Ozo, and, you know, it's gone from being 2K by 2K sensors to being, you know, up to 8K resolution and 120 frames a second, sorry, 60 frames a second native capture. It keeps being relevant. So that little camera we bought one, and it was, you know, very expensive at the time, and we were part of the Pioneer program as well, so, you know, we got money off and we had to provide Nokia with footage that they could use in their promotional material. And, you know, that little camera has done massive things for us and our ability to, like I said, learn what works and learn what doesn't work. And we've taken the learnings from that first week over the last couple of years, and we've worked for some incredible clients. We've worked for, you know, Champions League. We've been on set on Disney productions. And we've even made some VR for Nokia. So it's been a long road, and I'm still learning, very much so, you know. And we have learned how to... Well, we've tried to cement some of the rules, and I often call it the cinematic language of video VR. And I've also learned how to break them and what can and can't be broken. And along the way, I've watched other content as it's come out and watched other people make mistakes. And that those lessons are useful as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so quite often I'll give, you know, keynotes to clients, and they'll ask, you know, what about VR, what about VR, AR, you know, what is it? And there are some really hard and fast rules that you can't break, and there are some softer rules that you can break. And it just comes down to how brave you are and if you know how to break them.
Yeah, absolutely. So is the Ozo the only camera that you use there then, or... Is there any other?
No, we. Yeah, I mean, as we've gone on, we've had Insta 360 Pro, we've had Obsidian. We're now looking at Insta 360 Titan, and there's also a way to combine the Obsidian R and S to give you the best of both worlds. So there's lots of different cameras and rigs that we use, but the one that we own, because it was, you know, quite often you ring a hire house and a shoot's coming last minute and. I kind of want to know what I'm using before I get there. And it's hard to stay up to date with all the different types of software, all the different types of firmware. Is that unit going to come with 2.3? Is that unit going to come with 2.7? I just need to know what I'm doing. So we do have this sort of baseline where, right, we've got the Ozo. However, does this project need more resolution? Does this project need slow motion? If the answer to those questions is yes, then we might go for the Obsidian R, or we might go for the Obsidian S, or we might look at the Titan, or we might look at the Insta 360 Pro. Things like that are the questions that we ask, and we just make sure that what the kit we take is when we arrive and whack the tripod out, yeah, or the Mantis or whatever it is we're using, is best case tech.
Nice. And what about audio? What do you use to record audio on your gigs?
Well, if it's Ozo, that records ambisonic. A lot of the cameras record ambisonic, but if you're using something like the Mantis, you also want to record off-rig as well, because the Mantis can be quite loud depending on its speed and what it's doing. So if I'm recording dialogue, I just radio mic guys up, yeah, and then I tend to attach like a receiver and a Zoom recorder to the Mantis, so that, because half the job is hiding yourself, you know. This, yeah, even the Find Matt is a game we play in early edits before we've painted me out running away. There's a shot in our showreel where we're in the middle of Vietnam, and we're outside a temple filming, and I'm kind of just watching from behind a corner, and I know where I am because I was there. But then I sort of run out to stop the camera because we couldn't tether with the Wi-Fi. There was just too many Wi-Fi signals. And then I noticed that there's someone on a motorbike about to tear off. And you see me sort of half run out into the street, spot the motorbike, turn around really quickly and run back round the corner. And I've left that in because sometimes it's quite useful to show a client that, you know, everything is in shot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I had that, like, I did, because I've only, like, done a few bits and pieces here and there, but one of the first ones I did was, like, a property tour in Spain last year. And one of the shots, it was this guy had this massive garage downstairs in the house, but luckily it had, like, pillars. And they, so literally, right, as soon as you hit record, everyone was, like, trying to find a pillar to hide behind.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant, just watching it back, just seeing everyone then just going into a little, like, flurry, just trying to figure out where they're going to hide.
We were doing a shoot last week, a football skills shoot, and, you know, a couple of, like, first team players just showing us general, like, I don't know, how to receive a ball at the edge of the box and convert it into a goal. And halfway through, a major Premier League footballer just walks through the middle of set. Can't stop him because we're in his training ground,
yeah,
and he doesn't care. And it's quite funny. And, you know, I kind of almost want to leave it in because there's, like, this massive star walking through your shoe. But in the end, we have to go with another take. There's not a lot you can do, really.
No. And it's weird as well.
You know, with narrative stuff, I think it's quite often, and it comes down to, with bigger budget stuff, and as people start to take bigger risks and on narrative VR, like, if it's like a Victorian piece, just dress your crew as Victorian urchins, yeah, or, you know, your stuntman, because that's your production design. If I'm building sets now, then I'm building it with a view to VR. So I'm building places for people to hide, and I'm building in, you know, seats for people to do. We did some stuff for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office where I've got, you know, one guy in shot on a laptop. He's not on a laptop. He's the audio mixer. He's recording the sound. He's monitoring Phileas Fogg as he runs around the room. He's making sure that he's on mic. So, you know, there is stuff that we build into our production process now that is very specific to VR.
Yeah. So can you talk a bit more about, like, the projects that you have been working on? Is it just, like, solely client work, or have you been doing, like, any, like, personal projects?
Well, a lot, yeah, 90% of, we're an agency, 90% of what I do is client facing. So we make standard films as well. We do all sorts of stuff here. But yeah, probably my favourite piece from last year, we made a documentary for UEFA. So the Champions League trophy goes on tour every year. So they actually take the silverware and a couple of, like, major players, and they go on a worldwide tour. And it's a way for the, sort of, that brand to engage with people that would never be able to make it to match. So, you know, it goes everywhere. It goes through, like, the Caribbean, through India, Middle East, and then to Asia, and, you know, right the way through. I think it finished in Vietnam, and we kind of caught up with the trophy in Vietnam and did, like, a little 15-minute documentary about why they do that, and the sort of cultural differences between somewhere like Sweden and Vietnam, and how football, you know, becomes a world language, and that fandom is actually international. It doesn't matter where you're from. If you're a fan of football, you're a fan of football. And we got interviews with Ronaldinho and the Dybala brothers, and the access we got to shoot the spectacle of the trophy tour itself was unreal. You know, we're getting on the tour bus with those guys, and we're on stage when the pyrotechnics are firing, and you wouldn't get it in the UK because of health and safety, but because of where we were, they were just like, yeah, go for it, go and do it. And it was unreal. It was just a week shooting in Vietnam. Half of it, we're up at like 3 a.m. getting on the floating market in the middle of the you know, the Mekong Delta, and then the other, and then we're in a fish market, in the middle of the day, and then on stage at night with 40,000 people all going crazy as, you know, these fireworks go off and a huge sort of animated Heineken man kicks kicks the trophy across the crowd, and then it lands on the stage. It's just unreal. Like, and watching that piece back now, it's a really nice use of VR. It suits VR. It should have been VR, and you can look around and take it in, and you connect with the spirituality of Vietnam, and you connect with the passion of the fans when they're in the crowd. It does its job really well. But then there's other things that we've done that could have easily been either point of view or not VR, could have been standard film. And that led us down another road when we ask ourselves the questions of, you know, the rules. And probably now, one of the most important questions we ask straight away at the inception of a project is, should this be VR?
Yeah.
And we've made stuff that the client desperately wanted to be VR, but it shouldn't have been. And we've done it, and now we've learned from those mistakes, and we can say to someone, look, this actually doesn't fit. You know, we had one client who wanted to realise their annual fiscal report in VR, which is maths. You know, it did its job, but it could have been probably a bit snappier if it wasn't done in VR, just because of the nature of a VR edit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you want something like a lot of detail, a lot of, you know, you've got to get that data across. You want a choppy edit. You want something fast. You want to be able to just draw people along at your own pace and rhythm. Whereas with VR, the choppier you get, the more you start to lose your audience, because it starts to get confusing. And you'll know as well as I do, you know, you don't want to confuse your audience.
Yeah, or make them ill.
Or make them ill. Give them, or, you know,
that's never a
good destroy
point.
Their visual cortex. Yeah, as can happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the other rules. Don't yaw artificially. I always say, you know, you see bad pieces of VR when they're moving the camera, they're twisting it, they're turning it, they're flying around it left, right and centre. Linear lines, keep it simple. Move forward, move back, move side to side. Very occasionally you can get away with diagonal, but don't grab someone's face and tell them which way to turn their head. That's why there are 8 lenses. That's why you can look around. They make that decision. Yeah. We don't make that decision for them.
So where do you see VR going, and like just in terms of like both marketing and just in the long run?
I mean, it's probably been said before, but I think we're waiting for that sort of holy grail moment. We're waiting, and we've taken steps towards it. You look at like Doug Liman and the Invisible series and other really stunning pieces of VR. We're just waiting for someone to get it absolutely 100% right. And if someone came to me and went, here's loads of money, go and make something. And don't get me wrong, you asked me earlier on if I've done any personal projects. I've almost got stuff away a few times. It just comes down to budget. It comes down to being able to say, we want to shoot in that bank, or we want to shoot on that cruise ship, and I've got an idea, and it can be amazing. But it's getting someone to pay for it. Like Ramwidth isn't a startup. We haven't got 2 years and $8 million worth of investment to go and just do what we want. We've got to pay for our lights. We've got to pay for the other people that work here. So I can't go around just doing what I want. But where VR will go is a lot of people are going to start saying, ah, it was a fad. And it's not. It's here to stay. You look at things like web VR. You look at like other standards that are coming. It's here to stay. It's not a fad. It isn't even a new type of way to deliver content. This is a new type of content. This is different. This isn't 3D TV where you're watching the same stuff with a silly pair of glasses on. This is different. And like I said, we're going to get that watershed moment where someone gets it absolutely, and then every single marketeer and producer in the country is going to go, oh, wow, yeah, no, that's how you do it. Great. Yeah, guys, and that project, yeah, that one, yeah, that we're going to do that in VR now. And there's going to be tens of thousands of projects done correctly. The other thing that's going to change is the analytics side for marketeers and for people that are looking at things like advocacy and distribution. Once the headsets become smaller, lighter, faster, stronger, and they start to look back at the human eye, things like eye tracking, and then from there, you know, the kind of next step up, which is looking at stuff like pupil dilation and stuff, that's when we can really start to not only drill into the details, but make it work for us. So before, you know, with a standard piece of film, I can tell you what you were looking at and how long you looked at it for. With version one of VR, I had heat maps coming off the back of video, so I knew what exactly what people were looking at on screen, where, what their, you know, point of view was, head position, how long they dwelled on that little bit before they moved on, where they went to next, where they'd been before. I'm there now. But once I've got cameras looking back at the human eye, and I can not only check, you know, eye direction, I can look at pupil dilation, I can gauge heart rate, blood pressure, I can gauge things like desire, fear, embarrassment, uncomfortable. I can, you know, those sorts of insights will allow me to create things like branching storylines, you know, so I can control when the scare comes, I can control when she kisses him, I can hit you with the crescendo in the music based on your emotional connection to the footage. And they're important things, and they're important in narrative, but they're probably most important to people like marketeers and advertisements, because I'm trying to sell you something quite a lot of the time with moving image content, and if you can serve yourself your own perfect advertisement that you don't even know is perfect, then great. A subject that you maybe weren't connected with, we can wait till you do connect with it and then serve it you properly. That's the trick. That's unreal.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually.
I mean, you know, looking at that, like, say, being able to gauge desire, to be able to, I don't know, like, say we're selling someone a hotel, and there's different types of room. You know, you show them room one, you get nothing. Show them room two, a bit bigger, she likes it more, he likes it more. Show them room three, boom, they're in. That's it. This person likes a suite. They want something big. They want a dream. So let's keep going on the suite. Let's not show them room four. Let's stay where we are right now. Let's make it sunnier. Oh, yeah, they like it sunny. Cool. Let's make it Mediterranean. Yeah, here we are. Cool. Right. Let's look at Portugal. Let's look at these deals. Did they like golf? No, not into golf. Water sports? Boom. Here we are. It's branching storylines, staying with it. It's having enough of your own knowledge of your products and your the things you're selling to be able to drill right into the customers. So it's, you know, it's the evolution of like ECRM and things like that.
Certainly an exciting thought.
That's dangerous, like, and scary.
Yeah. But it's, at the same time, it's kind of cool. But yeah, let's hope Judgment Day doesn't happen anytime soon.
Yeah, but then again, for narrative as well.
Yeah.
I always say, you know, VR will expose a fake faster than anything else. You know, if you've got a narrative piece of VR and there's a bad actor in it, or there's a piece of the story that asks not only the viewer but also the actors or the characters to suspend their disbelief, it doesn't work. Your truth in VR has to be 110% true. And like I say, that has to be story truth, performance truth, spatial truth. You know, if a monster is going to attack someone and jump out on them, that monster has to, it can't just jump out from the left of screen. It has to approach from the rear of the shot, silently, stealthily. No one has to notice it. And it has to just jump out at the right point. Because on the intuitive viewing, the first time someone watches that horror film, it will jump out and they'll be scared. But I guarantee the second viewing, they'll be looking round, looking for that monster approaching, to see if it just appears suddenly. So you've got to have another type of truth, which is repetitive truth as well, which is even more difficult. There's a famous piece of VR about a bear attack. It's some young guy sat around a campfire and a bear suddenly appears. And the first time you watch it, it works, but the second time, it's quite easy to pick it apart because you know they'd have heard the bear, they'd have seen the bear, and then you're like, why didn't they run off? Or Yeah. And that one of them like gets really close to the bear when he's like trying to throw it some treats, and you're like, no, you'd have your hand off. And there's another piece from Suicide Squad as well, where there's like a piece of Suicide Squad VR, and that you're kind of you're in the Suicide Squad, you're going through an office block, and there's all these figures coming, and they're all there, all the characters are like shooting people, and Harley Quinn's hitting someone, and the Killer Croc's doing something, and it's amazing. You're like, whoa, this is ace. And then I watched it again, and the guy who's in the sort of Deadshot outfit, kind of, you can kind of see that he's towards the end, he's a bit bored.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
He kind of looks at the guy who's playing, I think it's a G.I. Joe character, and he kind of just gives him a little tap on the back. He's like, should we go? Is it over? Can we go now? I want to get my lunch. And it's really like, oh, mate, come on.
Yeah, it completely takes you out of it.
Yeah. I found it really funny, actually. And it just goes to show that, you know, there are some things that you can get wrong. And even with all the money and all the time, if that's wrong on the day, then that's wrong on the day. And probably with a standard shoot, they'd have gone, oh, let's cut away from that, because he kind of phones it in. You can't cut away with VR. Once you're there, you're there.
There's one I watched called Sisters. And again, it's like a horror experience where you're just in this one room, and then there's these two little dolls that pretty much terrorize you. But that's one, like you say, like you watch it first time around, scares the crap out of you, but you think next time around I'm ready for this because I know when these scares are coming.
Yeah,
but the way it's done is that, because like you say, you sort of turn around and you think, right, well, I'm gonna wait for this to come walking over to this side of the room and I'm gonna be ready for it, but it doesn't move. You could be sat there watching it forever and it won't move. It waits for you to look the other way.
Ah, nice.
And then as you turn back round again, then it's suddenly there, and you're not expecting it, because it's come a bit earlier.
It sort of gets it right.
Yeah. So it's really cleverly done. And that was one of those things where I thought, well, after the first one, it's not going to get me anymore. But every time I've watched it since, it's found a way.
It won't trick me again.
Yeah. Never mind.
I mean, me and a mate sat down, and he's a big producer. He produces big TV shows, really big TV shows. And we were like, right, if we were going to do something, what would we do? The first thing we said is, let's just not do a jump scare piece, because it's been done.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's been done well as well. People, you know, have used this medium to do really, really good jump scares. Mm. So it doesn't need doing again. The piece we came up with, I mean, God, the budget would have been huge, but we've got it there. And if someone ever comes in and goes, I want to do a really big budget piece of VR, have you got any ideas? We're like, yes, we got it. That would be what I would do. But we went down the sort of sci-fi route in the end, just because we just wanted to do something that didn't feel like it had been kind of done already.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think sci-fi lends itself really well. That kind of thing.
You want escapism. You want to be in a different world. You know, that's why we make these things. That's why, you know, Palmer Luckey back in the day wanted to go into video games. He wasn't just happy playing them on a TV. He wanted to be fully immersed in them. And that's why this whole thing is about. It's about immersion. It's about taking a step into a world out of your own. It's about doing something different and being amazed and being within the spectacle.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. So, what's your favourite piece of VR content at the moment, then?
I want to say my UEFA documentary, but I can't say that, can I?
You can say that if you want.
No, I can't. You know, it depends if we're talking about games or if we're talking about video.
Anything.
Or,
anything. Just in general. What one do you find that you always keep going back to?
Writing on Skyrim at the moment. I love a bit of that. Our Vive in the office. Run Skyrim, and I think for escapism, you can't beat a bit of, you know, getting out there, taking an arrow to the knee, getting fully involved in killing some trolls.
Who wouldn't want that?
Who wouldn't want
an arrow to the knee?
Yeah. Actually, I like to. I think the story arcs of Skyrim are really good, and as an immersive piece of content, it works really nicely. Film-wise, I rate Invisible, the series. I think what Doug Liman tried to do, or to a point did, was, you know, give VR some credibility. And, you know, there are other pieces as well that stand out, but as a series of narrative content, that that's there, you know. And he tried some interesting things, you know. There were obtuse cuts, there were strange angles, things that sort of challenged the viewer slightly. And I think for a more savvy VR viewer, you would watch Invisible differently to someone who was perhaps a first-time viewer. And that's maybe what hurt it a little bit, in that a lot of people that watched it, it was the first thing they never watched in VR. And I think sometimes you kind of need to learn how to watch something. Or you need to learn how to watch VR. I think if you watch a lot of stuff, then you'd probably take into Invisible quite quickly. But if it was your first viewing, it might be a bit more tricky.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Okay, well, I think that pretty much wraps things up. But where can people find you online?
Go to the Bramwith website, and there's all our showreels on there. And but because, obviously, we work for clients, if you want to watch the UEFA piece, you're going to have to go to the Champions League YouTube channel. If you want to look at the Nokia stuff, again, you're onto the Nokia YouTube channel. So it's because, obviously, our stuff has got clients' names on it, not ours. It's hard to find sometimes. But I'd look at, like, our head of innovation, like Dean Johnson. He's Active Right Brain on Twitter. He's got a lot of stuff going on, and it always puts links out to our stuff. Or find me on Twitter as well. I put stuff out. I'm Matt Littler on Twitter. But, yeah, just the website, and you can look at the showreel, and in there is loads of stuff that we've done.
Awesome. Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, thanks again to Matt for taking the time out of his busy schedule to have a chat. If you guys enjoyed it, then I'd be really grateful if you left a review on iTunes, as it really helps the podcast out a lot. To keep up to date with the latest episode releases online, go follow at VR Side Chats on Facebook and Twitter. And just on the off chance, if you're interested in what I'm up to, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Daniel K. Hatton. Thanks again for listening, and I shall see you guys next week.